Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Welcome back to the RTC Weekly Download. I'm your host, Jim Dolan. Today we're going to have an episode of Recollections at 30. This is an NBC program that celebrated NBC's 30th anniversary on the air, and they're going to be covering some of that ground. That's in the next 30 minutes. Right now, an old favorite comes up, and I'm sure those of you who like it are going to be waiting for this. This is Dragnet, and this one's called The Big Guilt from 1952.
Sound off for Chesterfield. Chesterfield, the only cigarette in America to give you premium quality in both regular and king size, brings you Dragnet.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you are about to hear is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent. You're a detective sergeant. You're assigned a homicide detail. You get a call that the body of a man has been found in an alley. He's been strangled with his own necktie. The body has been robbed. There's no lead to the killer. Your job, find him. Thousands are changing to Chesterfield, both regular and king size, because Chesterfield is the first and only cigarette to give you premium quality in both sizes.
That means king size Chesterfield contains tobaccos of better quality and higher price than any other king size cigarette.
It's the same fine tobacco as in regular Chesterfield, and there's enough to give you more than a 1/5 longer smoke. Yes, more than a 1/5 longer smoke from king-size Chesterfield.
So remember, Chesterfield is the only cigarette to give you premium quality in both regular and king-size.
Buy them either way you like them. Premium quality Chesterfield, and much milder.
Dragnet, the documented drama of an actual crime. For the next 30 minutes, in cooperation with the Los Angeles Police Department, you will travel step by step on the side of the law through an actual case transcribed from official police files. From beginning to end, from crime to punishment, Dragnet is the story of your police force in action.
It was Sunday, February 10th. It was cold in Los Angeles. We were working the day watch out of homicide. My partner's Frank Smith. The boss is Thad Brown, chief of detectives. My name's Friday. We'd gotten the call at 8:36 a.m., and it was 8:49 a.m. when we got to the corner of 18th and Winfield, the back alley.
Must be it there.
Yeah. Yeah, there's Harper.
Sergeant, back here.
Hi, Friday, Smith.
Harper,
hi.
Where is he?
Back here.
Who found him?
The fella gives his name as Alexander Jones.
Where's he now?
Al's got him out in the car. Figured you'd want to talk to him. Pretty bad off.
Yeah.
Must have had himself a real time last night. He's seeing things this morning. We picked him up just coming out of the alley. Stopped to talk to him. It looked like he was having a real rough time.
Jones, huh?
Yeah, probably not his real name. I've seen him around here before. There's the body.
Strangled.
Yeah, ambulance is here. Here's a slip. He was DOA.
Yeah. See how the tie is pulled up out of the shirt?
Looks like he was robbed. Pockets all turned inside out.
Uh-huh. Want to call the crime lab, Frank?
Yeah.
Found a couple of footprints over here in the gutter. Heel indentation looks pretty good.
Yeah.
Put this box over them. I don't know if they'll mean anything. Thought I'd better keep them for you, though.
Mm-hmm. It's like the body was dragged back here, doesn't it? Marks in the dirt.
Yeah.
How about the neighborhood, Harper? Anybody around here see anything?
Well, I don't know. There wasn't anybody on the streets when we picked up this Jones guy. Haven't had a chance to canvass the area. Didn't want to leave here, you know.
Yeah. Well, we better call the office head and send out a couple of men.
Call Lee. He'll be right out. Got him at home. He's sound asleep. Said he'd call the lab and have Alan bring the stuff out, and Lee'd come right here.
How about the coroner?
He's on his way.
Well, I want to call the office, Frank, and get some help checking the stores around, see if anybody heard anything.
I used the phone in the cigar store on the corner. Guy in there said he opened up about 7:15. Said he didn't know anything about it. Store's back door is right there. See the one with the cigar posters on it?
Yeah. All right, come on. I'll call in and then we can check some of the other places, huh?
All right. I'll wait here, Sergeant, until the rest of them come.
Fine, thanks, Harper. We'll be in the stores around the street side there.
Okay.
Let us know when Lee gets here, will you?
Yeah.
What do you think, Joe?
Well, I don't know. The way he's dressed there, good clothes, looked like he had money. Doesn't figure, does it?
Yeah.
What was he doing down here? A.M. I called the office and two teams of men were sent out to help us canvass the area. Frank and I checked with the owner of a liquor store who was getting ready to open for business. He told us that he'd come in early that morning to clean up his store and that he'd taken a load of trash out into the alley at about 8:25 a.m., but at that time he hadn't seen the body. He went on to say, however, that it was possible that it might have been there and he just didn't notice it. 9:26 a.m., Sergeant Jay Allen and Lieutenant Lee Jones from the crime lab arrived and began collecting the physical evidence. The body and the surrounding area were photographed. Photographs were taken of the footprints that Officer Harper had found. They were compared with the shoes worn by the victim, but they didn't match. The coroner went through the dead man's pockets but found nothing. Everything had been removed, all his personal effects, if any. The crew from the crime lab went through the alley and found a wallet behind the garbage cans at the rear of the liquor store. There was no money in it, but other papers hadn't been disturbed. Driver's license, Social Security card, and several business cards in the wallet bore the name of Arthur McKinley. The description on the license matched that of the victim. Comparison of the thumbprint on the driver's license with those taken from the body matched. McKinley's home address was listed as 9722 Willetta Street in Hollywood. The coroner removed the body. 10:52 a.m., Frank and I talked to Alex Jones, the man who had been in the alley where the body had been found. We had him take everything out of his pockets.
I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't kill anybody.
We didn't say you did. All we want to know is what were you doing in that alley?
I went there to get away.
From what?
People. They're no good. None of them. No good.
You got a job?
Yeah, I work.
What do you do?
Wash dishes sometimes.
Pearl diver?
No, sir. No pearl diver. I'm a bartender. I don't feel so good. You got anything to drink around here?
You know better than that, don't you?
I didn't mean booze. Something cold. Feels like somebody's closed a valve in my head. It feels like it's going to blow apart. Isn't there something, anything, as long as it's cold?
How about a Coke?
Yeah, be fine.
I'll get it for you. Want one, Joe?
No, thanks.
Mind if I go with you? Kind of stuffy in here.
All right, come on. We'll all walk down. You ever been arrested, Alex?
Yeah, a couple of times. Picked me up for being drunk.
What's your real name, Alex?
Stafford. Alex Stafford, that's the truth.
Where are you from?
Kansas.
Mm-hmm. What are you doing out here?
Figured that when I got out of the service, I'd come out here and go to work.
Yeah?
Got out here, spent a couple of days looking for a job, had my muster and out pay about $400. Figured I didn't have to go to work right away.
Uh-huh. Right, just a second. All right, here you go.
Thanks.
You want one, Frank?
No, thanks. I want to check R&I and see if they've finished the run on McKinley yet.
It's sure cold. Tastes good. Feel better.
That's fine. All right, let's go. Frank, see you back at the interrogation room.
Okay, Joe.
Want to stop at the office, give the coroner's office a call?
Yeah.
Like I was telling you, I figured that I didn't have to come up with a job right away, so I started to see the town. You know, try to find a place to work where I could maybe do some good.
What?
Where I could do some good. Where the tips would be good, you know, nice people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I went around to the bars, talked to the bartenders, checking around. Each of the places I'd have a drink, you know, just to be sociable.
Yeah.
It wasn't long before my dough was gone. I was flat broke, kicked out of my room. Can't blame the landlady. She carried me for a couple of months. Finally said I had to go.
All right, go ahead. What do you mean when you said that you were running away from people?
I got a job yesterday, washing dishes in a restaurant down on Spring. I worked like a dog. When I left last night, they paid me. I guess the boss knew I didn't have any money, no place to sleep.
Yeah.
I started to find a bed. And then I got to thinking that a drink might make me sleep better. So I stopped at a bar and had a couple more. I guess I fell asleep.
Yeah.
And anyway, I went into the alley, that one where you found the dead man, and I sat down and I went to sleep again. When I woke up, I was walking out when a cop in a car stopped me.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I didn't know the man was in there. Honest, I didn't. Now, you gotta believe me, because somebody's gotta believe me. I didn't know he was there.
Anything?
Not on McKinley. Found Alex Recker.
Yeah.
Like you said, a couple of drunk arrests, that's all.
I told you. Didn't I tell you that? Huh? I got nothing to hide. I didn't even know the man was there.
All right, take it easy. Anything from the coroner?
Yeah, Joe, I called. Fixes the time of death at about 11:30 last night. Body hasn't been posted yet.
All right. You prove where you were at 11:30 last night, can you, Alex?
I don't know. I was someplace.
Yeah, we know that, but where?
Well, I got to think. 11:30. I was still working. I was washing dishes in the place over on Spring.
You can prove that, can you?
Yeah, sure. The boss, he'll tell you. He saw me. I didn't leave until 12. That's when I left the place. 12 o'clock, he'll tell you. 12 midnight.
All right, Alex.
Can I go now?
Well, we got to put in a call first. Maybe it might be better if we held you over a little while.
Why? I haven't done anything.
Well, it's against the law to be drunk on the streets. You know that, Alex.
Yeah, I guess I do. You're going to put me in jail, huh?
No, we're going to have to book you. The judge will decide where you're going to go. Probably be the county work farm.
Yeah. Well, it's probably better that way. Give me a chance to get off the booze. Boy, I had it this time. Seeing those things. Just one thing, Sergeant?
Yeah.
I want to make sure you understand that you really believe me.
What's that, Alex?
I'm not a dishwasher. I'm a bartender.
p.m. We had Alex Stafford booked at the main jail on a charge of violation of 4127 LAMC, drunk. We called the place where he'd been employed and found that he'd been telling the truth about the time he had left the restaurant on Spring Street. 1:36 p.m. We drove out to McKinley's home in Hollywood. It was a small stucco cottage set into the side of a hill. In front of the house, there was a boy's bicycle and a smaller child's wagon. Frank rang the bell and we waited.
Yes?
Miss McKinley?
Yes, that's right. What do you want?
Police officers, ma'am. We'd like to talk to you.
It's about Arthur, isn't it? Isn't it?
It might be better if we talked inside, Mrs. McKinley.
All right. Come on in. You have to excuse the way the house looks. I haven't felt like cleaning it up. I've been so worried about Arthur.
That's quite all right, ma'am.
Now, what is it you want to tell me about him? He's dead, isn't he? You don't have to lie about it. I know he's dead. I spent the whole night thinking about it. You can probably tell I haven't gotten any sleep. I don't want you to lie about it. I want the truth. Arthur's dead, isn't he?
Yes, ma'am, he is.
I'll have to sit down.
Was there something we can get for you, Miss McKinley? Water, something like that?
No, nothing.
Why do you say you knew your husband was dead, ma'am?
I just knew it, that's all. I can't tell you how. I can't put it into words, but I just knew it, that's all. When he called last night, I knew.
What time was that, ma'am?
About 6:30. He said he was just leaving the shop and that he was on his way home. It was his birthday. He's going to stop and get some beer and a couple of bottles of bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
We're having some people in. He said he was going to stop for some things. And then he said he'd be right home.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, the children waited up for him till 10 o'clock. That's way past their bedtime. I let them wait up. They had some presents they wanted to give their father. Arthur Jr. had made a wallet and handcraft class at school, all tooled and carved and everything. It's on the table there.
Mm-hmm.
Little Burl got him an ashtray. She picked it out by herself. It's on the table, too. Guess maybe you'll never get it now.
I wonder if we could call your family doctor, ma'am. You don't look like you're well.
No. I just can't believe it yet. But I know it's true. That's funny, isn't it? I know it's true, but I don't believe it. I know it's true, and I don't believe it. How did it happen? Was it an accident in the car?
No, ma'am. He was murdered.
Arthur, he was murdered?
That's right, Miss McKinley.
Miss McKinley. There's no Mr. McKinley anymore. He was murdered.
Well, I think maybe you better let us call a doctor for you, ma'am, get you something.
No, there's nothing a doctor can do. Nothing anybody can do. Nothing. Who did it, you know? You know who killed it?
No, ma'am, we don't, not yet.
You said your husband called you from the shop, ma'am. What shop would that be?
That's the florist shop. Our shop. We owned it. He called me from there about 6:30 and said he'd be home. That he was going to stop for some things and then he'd be home. But he wasn't. I knew it. I knew it all night. I thought of what I'd say what I'd do, how I'd feel, but now none of it fits. None of it seems to matter. Nothing matters much. Nothing. He said he was coming right home.
Who's your family doctor, ma'am?
What'd you say?
Your family doctor, ma'am. Who is he?
Dr. Simpkins in Hollywood. Dr. Simpkins, Hollywood, 27083.
You want to call him?
Yeah.
He said he was going to pick up a few things and come right home. My husband, Arthur McKinley. You know that, do you?
Ma'am?
There is no Mr. McKinley anymore, is there?
We called the McKinley family doctor. He arrived and gave Mrs. McKinley a sedative. Frank and I talked to her before it took effect. We asked her about her husband's friends, his business associates. She could give us no new leads. She told us that her husband usually brought the weekend receipts from the store home with him on Sunday night so that he could make out the deposit slip for the bank. She said that he usually had about $300 to $400 on Sunday night. She gave us the name of the liquor store where he did business. 2:47 p.m., Frank and I drove out to the store.
Gentlemen, what can I do for you?
Mr. Kennedy?
Night.
Police officers, Mr. Kennedy. I'd like to ask you a couple of questions.
Sure, anything to help the police. Nothing that I've done, is it?
No, sir. It's about Arthur McKinley.
He get home last night? His wife called, seemed pretty upset. Nothing wrong, is it?
Was Mr. McKinley in here last night, sir?
Yeah, he was. Let's see, I guess it's about 6:45. Come in, got a case of beer, a couple of bottles of bourbon.
Was there anybody with him when he came in?
No, there wasn't.
Did he seem all right to you when he was here?
What do you mean?
Well, was he in good spirits? Did he act like anything was wrong?
No, of course that don't mean anything.
Sir?
Well, even if there was anything wrong with Arthur, you'd never know it. Always laughing, always had a joke. He had a great one last night, real funny.
Yeah?
He told the one about the two musicians that were walking down the railroad track, and one of them said to the other, "Boy, this is the longest stairway I ever been down."
Well, yes, sir.
And then the other musician said, "I don't mind that, but these low banisters are killing me." Low banisters. Say, what's this all about, anyway? Something happened to Arthur?
He's been murdered, Mr. Kennedy.
Arthur? Arthur McKinley? You sure?
Yes, sir. We're sure.
How about that? Only last night I saw him laughing away. He was killed. You know who did it?
No, sir, not yet.
How about that? But his wife's pretty upset.
Do you know anyone who might want to kill him?
No, not Arthur.
Anybody in the neighborhood he had quarrels with? Any disagreements?
No, not I can think of.
Well, has there been anybody new, anybody you don't know hanging around the neighborhood lately? Anybody who could have known about McKinley's carrying that money around with him?
Well, let me think. Yeah, come to think about it, there is a fella. Seen him around the last couple of days. Matter of fact, I saw him last night when I helped Arthur carry the beer out to the car. Sure, that's where I saw him.
Sir?
He was in the car with Arthur.
February 10th, 3:50 p.m. We continued to question John Kennedy. He told us that when Arthur McKinley had left the liquor store, he had carried a case of beer out to the car for him. Kennedy said there was a man waiting in the car. The liquor store owner told us that he had seen the man in the neighborhood on several previous occasions, that the man had talked to most of the shopkeepers in the vicinity asking for odd jobs. Kennedy went on to say that he had hired him himself once to wash the front windows of the store. He gave us a complete description and Frank called it into the office. A local and an APB were gotten out on him. Kennedy was unable to give us his name or tell us where the suspect might live. He agreed to go downtown to the city hall and look through the mug books for us. He called his brother down to take charge of the store, and as soon as he arrived, Kennedy was taken down to the office. 5:17 p.m. We drove back to the McKinley home. Mrs. McKinley had recovered from the initial shock of finding out that her husband was dead. We asked her if she knew where her husband's car was, and she told us that as far as she knew, he had driven it the night before and that she hadn't seen it since. She gave us the description and license number, and we called it into the office. A broadcast was gotten out on it. We asked Mrs. McKinley to go with us to her husband's store, and she agreed. On a table in back of the store, we found two empty beer bottles and a couple of glasses. Leighton Prince was called, and they came out and lifted two sets of fingerprints from the bottles and the glasses. Crime Lab came out and photographed the place. There was no sign of a struggle, but there was evidence that there had been a party there the night before. We drove Mrs. McKinley back to her home, and at 8:13 p.m., Frank and I checked back into the city hall.
Long day, huh, Joe?
Yeah, I'm getting a little tired. What do you want to eat tonight?
Doesn't make any difference. Go ahead.
Thank you. I get it. Homicide, Friday. Yeti. Mm-hmm. They did, huh? Who? Oh, let me get that. Yeah, I got it. Okay, thanks, Dean. Yeah, you bet. Good night. It was Bergman. They made the prints on that bottle and glass.
Yeah. A
fellow named Fred Girard did time for armed robbery.
You are listening to Dragnet, the authentic story of your police force in action.
We like to give you the facts about Chesterfield so you can be your own judge.
Chesterfield is the first and only cigarette to give you premium quality in both regular and king size.
Chesterfield is the first and only cigarette to tell you what it's made of. The world's best tobaccos, kept tasty and fresh by pure and costly moistening agents, the best that money can buy. And Chesterfield cigarette paper is of the highest purity.
Now, Chesterfield is the first and only cigarette to present this scientific evidence on the effects of smoking.
A medical specialist is making regular bi-monthly examinations of a group of people from various walks of life. 45% of this group have smoked Chesterfields for an average of 10 years. He reports that he observed no adverse effects on the nose, throat, and sinuses of the group from smoking Chesterfield. Either way you like them, regular or king size, you'll find premium quality Chesterfields much milder.
Sunday, February 10th, 8:30 p.m. Frank and I pulled a package on Fred Girard. He'd been arrested in 1942 on a charge of violation of 211 PC. He'd been convicted and had served 5 years in the penitentiary at San Quentin. We checked back with John Kennedy, the man who had seen Arthur McKinley leave the liquor store in the company of the man we figured to be the murderer. When we entered the mug room, he was talking to Sergeants Joe LaMonica and Danny Galindo. They told us that so far he had been unable to identify the man he had seen with McKinley. We showed him a mugshot of Girard, and he positively identified it. Kennedy went on to say that as far as he was concerned, there could be no mistake, and that as far as he knew, Girard was the last man seen with the victim before his death. McKinley's car had been found 2 blocks from the alley where we'd found the body. In the back of it, the officers found the remainder of the case of beer and the 2 bottles of bourbon. Leighton Prince went out and dusted the car. They came up with 1 good set of prints other than the victim's. When these were checked, it was found that they matched the file copies of Girard's fingerprints. 9:46 p.m. We drove out to the address listed in Girard's package. His landlady showed us to his room. It was evident that he hadn't been in it the night before. Frank and I waited for him to return. 10 p.m. 11. 11:30.
What are you doing here?
You Fred Girard?
Yeah, that's right. Who are you?
Police officers.
Oh, cops. What do you want with me?
You know a man named Arthur McKinley?
Why?
You know him?
Yeah, I know him. Anything wrong with that?
When'd you see him last?
Last night.
Where?
At his store. I came by about 6:15. We talked for a while, and then he closed the store. He said he had to get home for a birthday party, something like that. We went down the street to Kennedy's to get some beer, and then he went back to the store. I heisted a couple, and then I left.
What time was that?
Well, I guess about 8:30 or so. I had to meet a guy out in Santa Monica, so I left.
You left McKinley at his store?
Yeah, that's right. So what's this all about? What are you giving me problems for? I haven't done anything.
All right, take everything out of your pockets. Put it right down here.
Look, you got no right to barge in here. Tell me what to do. I'm clean.
And you got no reason for not cooperating now, have you?
Well, I suppose not.
Then take everything out of your pockets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Keys.
Your money in your wallet?
Yeah.
How much you got?
I don't know. I have to count it.
All right, count it.
Let's see. 5, 6, 7, 8 bucks. I don't know. 56, 7, 8, 9, 9. 92 cents. Canadian penny.
Was there anybody with McKinley and you when you were drinking?
No, just went in the back of the store to have a beer, a little talk. We got along pretty good. He used to hire me once in a while, clean up a store, sweep out, things like that.
Yeah. Was he feeling all right when you left him?
I guess so. I didn't ask him, but he didn't say anything about it. Just said he had to get home for a party, that his wife would be hacked if he was late. Like I said, I left at 9:15. You might ask Stu Bennett. He might be able to tell you something.
Who's he?
Owns a little grocery just down the street from McKinley.
You say he might know about McKinley?
Yeah, he was there when I left. I was walking out when Mr. McKinley opened the door. Bennett was walking by. He said he had some things he wanted to talk to McKinley about.
Mm-hmm.
But when I left, Bennett went in the store. What's this all about anyway? Something happened to McKinley?
He's been murdered.
Oh, no kidding. He's a nice guy. You figured I did it, huh?
That's the way it looked.
Yeah. Well, I did some time. I won't try to con you. You'll probably know all about it anyway. I wouldn't kill anybody, though. I'm going straight. I've been working every day since I got out.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, though.
Yeah?
You might talk to Stu Bennett. He was with him when I left.
Fred Girard gave us a complete description of Stuart Bennett. We called the name into R&I, but he had no record. We checked Bennett's store and found a card on the front door that gave his home address. Frank and I drove out to his house. He lived in a new apartment development in the southwest section of town. Monday morning, 12:47 a.m., we rang the bell to his apartment.
He's probably asleep.
Yeah. Want to try it again?
Yeah.
Who is it?
Like talk to you.
Just a minute.
Yeah? Police officers. I'm Frank Smith. This is my partner, Joe Friday.
How do you do? Want to come in?
Right.
Well, what is it you wanted to talk to me about?
You know a man named Arthur McKinley? Do you?
I knew you'd find out. I knew it. I knew it right after it happened. I knew it right away.
All right, you want to get dressed?
Yeah, all right. I came home last night after it happened. I thought about it. I thought and thought. I wanted to go and tell you about it. I knew that I'd done a terrible thing. Killed Arthur. Killed another human being. You got to understand one thing, Mr. Friday.
What's that?
It's important to me. I'm not a vicious man.
Why'd you kill him?
I stopped last night to talk to him about all of us getting together as sort of a pool, hiring Fred to sort of take care of all the stores. That's what I went to see him about. I thought it'd be nice to have someone to take care of the stores, you know, wash the windows, sweep up, and we'd all chip in and pay him. Sort of a pool, like I said.
Yeah.
We talked. Arthur wasn't too much in favor of the idea. Said he'd been thinking about giving Fred a regular job in the flower shop. Said things were real good with him. He thought he'd take on an assistant. Things were going real fine for him.
All right. You better get dressed. We'll go downtown.
After I killed him, I took him out of the store and put him in an alley.
Yeah?
Now, I wanted to come and tell you about it. I went down to City Hall. I walked up the stairs on Spring Street. You know the big ones?
Yeah.
I was going to give myself up. I wanted to tell you about it. And then when I got there, the doors were closed. The sign said to use a Main Street entrance. I sat down on the stairs. Sat there for a long time. I thought about telling somebody about what I'd done. And then I walked around by the police department. On the walk, it goes around. I looked into the window and saw the detectives. I wanted to go right in and tell them about it.
All right. Come on. Get your clothes on. Let's go.
Now, that should prove it to you.
What's that?
I'm not a vicious man.
The story you have just heard was true. The names were changed to protect the innocent.
On June 5th, trial was held in Department 97, Superior Court of the State of California, in and for the County of Los Angeles. In a moment, the results of that trial.
Now, here is our star, Jack Webb.
Thank you, George Fenneman. Friends, remember now, Chesterfield is first to present this scientific evidence on the effects of smoking. A medical specialist is making regular bi-monthly examinations of a group of people from various walks of life. 45% of this group have smoked Chesterfields for an average of 10 years. He reports that he observed no adverse effects on the nose, throat, and sinuses of the group from smoking Chesterfield. Either way you like them, regular or king size, you'll find premium quality Chesterfields much milder.
Stuart Carlisle Bennett was tried and found guilty of murder in the first degree. He is now serving his term in the state penitentiary, San Quentin, California. Murder in the first degree is punishable by death or by confinement in the state penitentiary for life. You have just heard Dragnet, a series of authentic cases from official files. Technical advice comes from the Office of Chief of Police W.H. Parker, Los Angeles Police Department. Technical advisors, Captain Jack Donahoe, Sergeant Marty Wynn, Sergeant Vance Brasher. Heard tonight were Ben Alexander, Eddie Firestone, Carolyn Jones, Herb Vigran. Script by John Robinson. Music by Walter Schumann. Hal Gibney speaking.
Sound off for Chesterfields. Either way you like them, regular or king size, you'll find premium quality Chesterfields much milder.
Chesterfield has brought you Dragnet, transcribed from Los Angeles.
Tonight, more adventure with Barry Craig, confidential investigator, on NBC.
And sorry, the recording ends before we get the NBC chimes to make it official, but now you know they should have been there. Next up is Recollections at 30, and this is from 1956.
In just a moment, Recollections at 30. But first, the accent is on sports this weekend as Monitor takes you around the country. The schedule includes some of the nation's biggest golf tournaments, racing meets at Roosevelt Raceway in New York, Thistle Downs in Cleveland, and even a feature on Russian horse racing by Irving R. Levine in Moscow. You'll also meet Althea Gibson, tennis player, and five-year-old golf pro Linda Lewis, plus many other top names in the sports world. It's a full weekend of everything from everywhere, including visits with celebrities like Johnny Ray, Gloria DeHaven, Stephen Allen, and many others. Join Monitor this weekend. And now stay tuned for Recollections at 30 on NBC. Recollections at 30. NBC proudly presents by transcription some of the great moments from the 30-year history of radio network broadcasting. Every week at this time, reminisce with us and hear the stars, the songs, the great moments in sports and special events from the past three decades, all culled from NBC's files by a man who can remember many of the people and many of the events of these earlier days of broadcasting, Ed Herlihy.
Thank you, Fred. Ladies and gentlemen, it's going to give me the greatest of pleasure to introduce to you each week on this series so many of the fine things that have been done on radio in the past. During this last week, I've been busy blowing the dust off the recordings of hundreds of broadcasts. And when I put those recordings on the turntable and listen to the songs and the jokes and the political speeches even and the ball games and fights and interviews, I realize anew that as radio goes on year after year, it makes a record of the history of our time. I think that you'll be as delighted as I am to hear what made us laugh in 1930, what thrilled us in 1938, and what numbers we danced to in 1927. Well, let's get to it then, shall we? Recollections at 30. You remember 1934? Well, there was a depression then. The history books tell us we were worried, and we were. But we were also amused sometimes, and happy sometimes, too. That's what the dry history book forgets. But in the records that I've been spinning this week, the record is clear. NBC had a show in 1934 called Radio City Party.
Welcome to the Radio City Party. RCA Radiotron Company presents the Radio City Party with John B. Kennedy, interviewer of the great, stars of the Maxwell House Showboat, and Frank Black and his Victor Recording Orchestra. Ladies and gentlemen, John B. Kennedy.
Radio friends, the RCA Radiotron Company brings a new series of programs to you with a novel idea. Radio is either a mask or a mirror. It hides personality or reveals it. The makers of RCA Radio Tubes, with the kind cooperation of leading sponsors and the gracious aid of leading stars, will give you each week in the Radio City Party informal but informative close-ups of your radio favorites.
Who hasn't heard the genial voice of Captain Henry of Maxwell House Showboat? His breezy ballyhoo shows off that fine show to the best advantage. Who is Captain Henry? He's one of America's foremost character actors. Charles Wininger, star of a score of hits, including the original stage showboat. Here is Charles Wininger, Captain Henry, looking every bit as genial as he sounds, with a ruddy complexion 30 years younger than his silver locks.
I'm mighty happy to meet you all, folks. Thank you. Captain Henry speaking to you.
And as you say yourself, Captain Henry, this is only the beginning. You began by being born Charlie Wininger where? Ashland, Wisconsin. When?
Now, wait a minute, John. This is an interview, not an expose.
Well, that's true enough, Jolly. Actors like spinsters can take a discount on their raises. An actor is sometimes a ham with a scrambled ego, but Charles Wininger learned his art in a hard school.
Yes, indeed. I was practically reared in a theatrical trunk.
Ah, such a jolly little elf as he was, and he looked like Santa Claus. Charles Wininger. Way back then, there were attempts to present in amusing form the everyday life of little people. Radio became extremely adept at this sort of thing, as we all know. And among the shows that showed the way to future writers and producers was the one called Clara, Lou, and Em. Clara and Lou and Em were neighbors, and one of them was always getting into some kind of predicament. This excerpt comes from the early 1930s.
Want to buy a lot? And could you find the lot after you bought it? Well, Clara, Lou, and Em have both answers. Don't look now, but isn't this their car coming up the driveway?
Well, the lot's out there someplace. I've seen it. Let's get out.
Well, I'm glad you saw it, Em.
Great Scott, I bet we wasn't within 5 miles of it. You never recognized a thing, did you?
Well, Clara, every time I said turn right, you turned left. And every time I said turn left, you turned right.
Yes, and when did you tell me? You'd wait every time till I put me across and then yell turn left.
And then you'd turn left. But why didn't you turn left?
Well, because you never yelled in time.
But you turned right.
Well, Em, I have got to go with the car. I can't be yanking it every which way on instant notice.
Oh, quit standing there on the sidewalk arguing. What's dead is dead.
Oh, dear girls, that's my phone ringing in there, ain't it?
Yes, Em.
Oh, that's him. That's the salesman. Oh, what'll I tell him?
Well, just tell him you ain't decided yet.
No, Em, you better tell him you don't want it.
Why?
Well, I ain't got time to go into it now. Just tell him you don't want it, because you ain't got the money.
Well, I think it's smarter to hold him off.
Oh, hello? Oh, dear, I thought it was you.
Tell him you don't want it, Em.
Well, Clara, maybe it'll be gone by morning. Uh-huh. Well, yes, uh-huh. Yes.
Em, listen to me.
What?
You and Ernest can't buy that lot. Why don't you tell him so and be done with it?
Well, he's a kind of an optimistic fella, Clara. He don't take discouragements awful easy.
Well, let me talk to him. I can discourage him.
Well, all right. hello? Say, here's a lady that's going to be discouraging. Just a minute.
Hello. This is Mrs. Roach, mister. Yes, I'm a friend of Mrs. Kruger's. Why, I thought I might just well tell you, she ain't going to buy that lot.
Well, Lou, maybe it's just as well.
No.
We ain't got any $3,000 or even $100.
Yeah, I know she did, but she's just being nice. Well, she's timid. She can't help it.
Oh, now, Clara, don't make me out to be some kind of a ninny.
$3,000 ain't any bargain. Well, because for one thing, she ain't got $3,000. Oh. Oh, well, now, why didn't you say so in the first place? Wait a minute. Em, he thinks maybe you could get that for $2,500.
Oh, really?
Hello? Listen, I'll tell you one thing. The lot ain't worth $2,500. No, I haven't saw it. Well, just because I don't think it is, it ain't worth $2,500. Well, I don't know.
Oh, ring off, Clara. There's no use hanging on with it.
What's the best you think you could do on it? $2,000, huh? I'll give you $1,800.
What? Are you buying it now, Clara?
No, sir, not a nickel more.
Are you buying it, Clara?
Well, no. Wait a minute. Em, he wants to know if that's definite.
What's definite?
$1,800, Em, that's a bargain.
You mean for I and Ernest?
Well, yes, you're the ones that's buying it, ain't you?
Well, yes, we're buying it.
Good. Hello. Say she'll take it.
Well, there you are. Now, let's see. Next, the late and great Fred Allen. No more need be said except that in this selection from his radio show, Don McNeil was his guest. Here they are.
This gentleman, your name, sir?
Lomax Nishball.
What is your occupation, Mr. Nishball?
I work in the automat. I'm a lettuce vendor.
Lettuce vendor, the automat?
Yeah, sometimes when they put a salad in one of them little compartments, the wet lettuce hangs out and they can't close the door, you see.
And you?
I bend the lettuce back so they can close the door. With rhubarb, it's stiff. I bite it off.
All right, Mr. Nishball. Are you ready to play Break the Contest?
Yes, sir.
How much money do you have?
Well, I ain't got no money. All I own in the world is what I got on.
Oh, you've got to bet something.
Well, all right. Tell you what, I'll bet you my coat against your coat.
Mr. Nishball, I got yourself a bet
Nishball.
Here. Yeah. What category have you chosen?
Music.
All right, it's your coat against my coat. Now, here's your first question, Mr. Nishball. Who wrote the Kachaturian saber dance?
The Kachaturian?
That's correct,
oh,
Mr. Nishbaugh.
Correct, really?
You and my coat, I'll take that off here. Thank you. Fine. You now have two coats. Would you like to try for four?
Four coats? Yes, sir. I'd like to try for four coats.
All right. In one word, finish the line of this popular song. Bongo, 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 I don't want to leave the what?
Bongo, bongo, bongo.
It's one word.
Manana?
No. Bongo, 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 I don't want to leave the Congo.
Oh, that's a song?
Yes, you lose, Mr. Nishbaugh. I'll take my coat back and your coat,
well, here,
too,
you take
if you don't
your
mind.
Coat. You have the both coats now.
Yes,
all right. What's your next question, Mr. McNeil?
What are you betting this
Let
time?
Let me see. What could I... Oh, my belt. I'll bet you
all
my belt.
All right. For one belt. What was Peter Tchaikovsky's middle name?
Bongo, bongo,
no.
Bongo.
I'm sorry.
You lost
Ilya.
Again.
Yeah. Take off your belt.
Yeah, I lost again.
Thank
well,
you very much.
I'm gradually getting the hang of it. I'm getting the hang of it.
What do you want to bet now?
Well, what could I bet now?
Yeah.
Well, all I've got left to bet is my trousers.
Your pants.
You'll be sorry.
Come on, give me the question. I got to win back me coat and belt, Mr. McNeil.
All right. For one pair of pants. Who wrote Alexander's Ragtime Band?
Alexander?
No, I'm sorry. It was Irving Berlin.
Could you repeat the question, please?
No.
Could you repeat the answer?
Now quit stalling, Mr. Nishbaugh. You lost your pants. Come on, take them off. Give
well,
them to
Well, all
me.
Right,
on.
Mister. I don't know what...
That was Town Hall tonight, and quiz shows in those days, well, they paid off rather poorly compared with our quiz shows of today. Some of the younger listeners may be amused to learn that once upon a time you found out how the world's heavyweight thought had come out by waiting until your newspaper was delivered in the morning. But radio changed all that. Sports announcers brought you to the ballpark and the football field and to the ringside. Back in the 1930s, the announcer that sports fans listened to most avidly was NBC's colorful Graham McNamee. I came across the complete recording of the famous Bear-Canera fight. Would you like to hear the terrific excitement in the closing moments of that battle? All right, here's the voice of Graham McNamee.
And here it is again. Bear comes in like a shot of lightning this time. Drives his left to the side of the face. Then his right and left both to the body. While Primo seems to be to have come to some, he has a tremendously large swelling on the left side of his face from those terrific right-hand blows of Bear. It was that terrific left hand in the stomach over there that started it, and I believe Carnera claimed it was low, and the referee jumped in for a moment. Otherwise, everybody around here believed that it would have been a knockout. And then, a terrific right hand to the side of Carnera's face, and Carnera goes down again, but only for the count of one. The man won't stay down, and he swings a hard left to Bear's face, but Bear is following him now. Carnera is very flimsy on those powerful legs of his, and Bear seems to feel that he can take him close any time. But Carnera drives in with his straight left again, and then swings his right to the side of Bear's head. Oh, this is a scrap. Oh, boy, oh, boy. Bear is feeling Carnera out for that thing that'll end the fight if it's possible. And then Carnera put over a straight left to the face again and another straight left to the face. Then Bear swung a terrific haymaking right hand on the side of Carnera's head and almost knocked him down. Carnera has fallen. Carnera has fallen again, but he is up instantly. The man won't stay down. Talk about nerve. He'll fight till he's dead, that man. He'll fight till nothing can stop him. Carnera is almost through, though. Nobody can do it. And finally, the referee motions Bear to his corner, and he should have done so. He should have done so. Bear begged referee Donovan to stop the fight, not allow the punishment to go on any longer, because it was too fearful, and Bear couldn't stand it. Wait, I'm going to get Bear. And now I'll have Zach Bear over here in a minute, who has just won the heavyweight championship of the world.
Hi, Graham. Hello, kiddo.
Oh, Mother, I want to say hello to you. I'm very happy. Joe Humphreys is now raising Mac Bear's hand in token of winning.
Hello,
Mom.
Back to the good old USA. Mac Bear.
And that's what happened 22 years ago on the night of June the 14th, 1934. A colorful era. Broadcast by one of the most colorful reporters of all time, Graham McNamee.
Also, back in the 30s, if you knew the obscure work of a minor poet or the shape of the leaves on some tropical flower, like as not, you sent a question to...
Information, please. Wake up, America. Time to stump the expert. Trot out your toughest questions and send them to us with the right answers. Four experts every Tuesday night will answer them correctly or pay you $5 for every question that stumps them. And each question accepted gets you $2. Our master of ceremonies is Clifton Fadiman, literary critic of the New Yorker magazine. Mr. Fadiman.
Good evening, everybody. Mr. Franklin C. Adams and Mr. John Kieran are here again this evening. Our guests of honor have both been with us before, Miss Oscar Levant and Mr. Ben Hecht. Are you all ready, gentlemen? Here we go. The first question is from Mrs. A.B. Churchill of 27 Washington Avenue, Nyack, New York. The first lines of the following sets of couplets will be read, and you will have to complete them. Are you ready? One. 10 little Indians standing in a line. 10 little Indians standing in a line. Miss Kieran.
One walked away and then there were nine.
Very good. 9 little Indians swinging on a gate. Miss Kieran again.
One fell off and then there were eight.
He certainly knows his Indians. 8 little Indians climbing up toward heaven. Miss Kieran.
One fell down and then there were 7.
7 little Indians picking up sticks.
One broke his neck and then there were 6.
That was Mr. Kieran, I needn't tell you. 6 little Indians playing with a hive.
Mr. Kieran? One was stung and then there were 5.
And now you other gentlemen can leave the room and come back in about 3 or 4 minutes if you wish. 5 little Indians on a trap door.
One fell through and then there were 4.
Thank you, Mr. Kieran. 4 little Indians up in a tree.
One jumped out, and then there were 3.
3 little Indians out in a canoe.
One was drowned, and then there were 2.
2 little Indians playing with a gun.
One pulled a trigger, and then there was 1.
1 little Indian living all alone. 1 little Indian living all alone.
He died, and now they're unknown.
Good enough.
Nowadays, we are quite used to husband and wife shows, those informal and chatty sessions in which a clever married couple discuss every topic under the sun. One of the first of these shows is a stranger to me, but its title was Coffee and Donuts. On this particular show, these folks talked about current events, but since the date was 1934... the events they talked about are no longer current. Listen.
The makers of Scratchies, America's newest and fastest-selling woolen undergarment for women, invite you to come along with them at this time to 565 Main Street and listen in at the breakfast table.
Have some more hot coffee, Joe.
Baby, these donuts are great.
I hear the coffee's good, too.
Yeah, good and hot.
Oh, Joe, you oughtn't to wash your food down like that. You ought to chew it before you swallow it.
I think I'm late, baby. I see the Higgins kids over there starting for school. Must be about 20 minutes past already.
Well, if you'd remember to take the cops downtown and have a fix, you wouldn't have to be guessing all the time. Are you listening to me, Joe? Joe, do you even hear me?
Yeah. I'm reading about Jean Harlow. She's getting a divorce.
Oh. She was married only a little while ago.
Yeah, I know, but she's calling it off.
What's the reason she's getting...
Wait, look. He takes the newspapers to bed and reads it.
Hmm, don't blame her for hollering.
Yeah, and I don't blame him for wanting to get off with the paper somewhere so he can enjoy it before she mixes it up.
How do you know she mixes it up?
Yeah, all women do. That goes for you too, baby.
Well, you got a nerve. I don't mix up. I grasp things.
Yeah.
I go through it quicker than you do. I don't bother with the print and the stories much.
Hmm. Headlines today are forgotten tomorrow. Yesterday, all we were hearing was Babyface Nelson. Big headlines. His body was found full of bullets.
Yeah, see, that's right. And where is he now?
Well, they probably melted him down to get the lead back. After all, those bullets belong to the government.
Oh, that's funny.
I think so.
Oh, you're a funny guy. Hi.
Here's some more about your boyfriend, Huey Long, the kingfish. Boy, he's certainly doing things like that. He's going to have a moratorium and cancel all debts to help the poor people. He's traveling all over the other states, Arkansas, Tennessee, and Kansas, starting a new party. He, you know, he's back in that state college football team, and he made one of the boys a senator. And now, Huey figures, he'll take them to California for the Rose Bowl game. What do you think of that?
Just a lot of Huey.
Huey. Oh, what a joker. Yeah.
Musically speaking, Recollections at 30 would like to take you back into the great swing era, starting around 1928 and continuing up until the early 1940s, when the great bands of our time came into being. We'd like to play a little quiz game, though, with you right now. Do you know this music? Can that be? And it certainly awakens pleasant memories in my mind. Well, that's all the time we have for now for Recollections at 30. I like the idea. Do you? Well, if you do, I wish you'd write and tell me about it. Ed Herlihy. You know, radio has been America's outstanding entertainment medium for years. And the wealth of comedy and music, great stars, drama, personalities, is now mine, through the courtesy of the National Broadcasting Company, mine to recall for you. So, if you remember a special broadcast that was a favorite of yours, perhaps a comedy moment, or perhaps you'd like to hear the voice of Al Jolson or Rudy Valley again, well, if you'd like to hear it again, drop a note to Recollections at 30. Ed Herlihy, National Broadcasting Company, Radio City, New York, and I'll try to find it for you. So, until next week at the same time, Recollections at 30 will return with more of the same. The stars and special events of yesterday and even the day before. You have been listening to Recollections at 30, one of a series of recorded highlights from the 30-year history of radio network broadcasts. Next week at the same time, there will be more of the great stars, great moments of the past, presented by NBC Radio and introduced by Ed Herlihy. Recollections at 30 is directed by Bob Maurer. Fred Collins speaking.
Hear the harrowing true drama of alcoholism on Skid Row tomorrow night on NBC Radio.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.